This is WMUK's Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan, where we explore all kinds of local music weeknights at 8 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. I'm Kara Lawrence. Earlier today, Andrew Kohler, conductor of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, stopped by to talk about their concert this Sunday in Chenery Auditorium, starting at 4 o'clock. It features Stolberg International String Competition bronze medalist Laura Park playing the Dvorak Violin Concerto. We also discussed the music of Norman Delojoyo and Johann Strauss Jr. I started off by remarking that this is a very special season for the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony. Well, it's an exciting season for the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra. 75 years.
Exactly right. We're very proud. This makes us, I think by our current estimate, the third oldest youth orchestra in the country. So we've been around for quite a while. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, as part of the celebration for the 75th anniversary, one of the board members has been working very hard on kind of compiling a richer history of the organization than we've thus had. We do have one on our website, but it's a bit cursory, you know. And this is Sarah Headland, who's also a musician in town, and she's been diving into the sort of personalities of the former directors and really some of the motivations they had and some of the ways they were perceived. And she showed me some of what she's written up, and it's just fascinating. It's really exciting. It's amazing to see how rich this history and have it come alive in this way, right? To get a sense of, you know, of course, someone like Julius Stolberg, who was, I think, for some 30 years music director of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony, and whose competition, this string competition we have in town, is named after, looms very large on the Junior Symphony and on Kalamazoo's music scene. But it's really nice to kind of see some things about who he was as a person, how the students perceived him, how much they loved him, what he imparted to them. And it's just been that much more exciting for me to think of being a part of this really long legacy.
And that's rather a hard thing to do, to keep, to have. You can't have a full-time librarian in an organization like this, which, you know, is a lot of volunteers, a lot of hard work going into concerts and music, but so you're lucky to have Sarah.
Oh, we certainly are. And in addition, other members of the board have worked together and put together a small exhibit of sort of artifacts that represent the history of the Junior Symphony. And that's currently at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum right now. And both of those projects have been really exciting to see take shape and to have our board really commit to sort of exploring this history even more richly.
What were some of the surprises? Were they places the orchestra had gone on tour, or some of the guest artists surprised you? Or
I think some of the surprises were, one of my favorites was seeing that the students had compiled a list of quotes from Stolberg, things that he liked to say in rehearsal. And I have the sense that he was a nicer man than I was, but nevertheless, we're saying many similar things. So it was kind of fun to see the sort of resonance through the ages, you know, that in some ways there are some basics that kind of repeat themselves when you're working in these kinds of contexts. And it was also exciting to see the touring history because, you know, one of the exciting things, in addition to many exciting things that are happening this season, is that the orchestra is going to undergo a tour for the first time in many years. It's been, gosh, I think decades now since we've taken our last international tour. And we're going to go to China, which is particularly exciting in this context because the orchestra historically, even though it's been years since we've gone, has gone before to South America, it's gone to Australia, it's gone to Europe several times. So it's nice to add a new continent to the travels of that will go down in the history books for the Junior Symphony for years to come now.
When will the trip to China be?
That'll be at the end of our year in June of 2014.
So, wow, you're probably well into fundraising efforts for that now.
We're working on it, as we are, yes.
Well, one way you can support the Junior Symphony is to join them at their concert this Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. It's a concert featuring, of course, a great showpiece for the orchestra, as well as a concerto performance bringing back one of the Stolberg medalists this year.
Exactly. It's sort of nice that I got a chance to talk about Julius Stolberg as the longtime music director of the Junior Symphony, because here, of course, is another way that his legacy carries on in town, this competition, which, you know, I believe, if I remember correctly, we saw each other there at the competition last spring, and it's always one of the most exciting nights of music making in Kalamazoo, I think. I just simply love hearing it. And Laura Park was the bronze medalist from that competition. But you know as well as I that that can go either way, you know. I mean, the bronze medalist could be a gold medalist with a slightly different set of judges. The level is just intensely high and so wonderfully competitive. She's a tremendous violinist. I think she's from the Chicago area originally. And she's at Curtis now, you know, widely considered one of America's premier conservatories. She played an absolutely beautiful Sibelius concerto. And, you know, I talked to her about it. The typical thing, of course, is that the soloist plays the same thing that they played at the competition. But the level of these soloists, I think, is getting so high that I often feel that I, when I ask them, you know, you probably played the Sibelius concerto because it's something you've done a lot and it's really, really, you know, in your hands and you knew there was the right piece for a competition. But is there anything else that you are eager to play, maybe with orchestra? And in fact, she said, oh, well, you know, I have already played, I think she won a concerto competition to play with the Chicago Symphony. I think she did the Sibelius, if I've got that right, or another major American orchestra at any rate. So she said, maybe, you know, I'm learning the Dvorak concerto. What do you think about that? And I thought, perfect.
Why
so, I mean, I have complete faith in someone who plays like this, that she has any repertoire that she would bring to us, she will play as really a master musician already. At the tender age of, gosh, I don't know, 20 probably, I think she is right now. Maybe not even 19. So we decided on the Dvorak concerto, and it's an absolutely fantastic piece of music. I think it gets overshadowed a little bit by the cello concerto, which is another very magnificent work, but the violin concerto has lots to offer, and I was it's something that I actually played in high school as a violinist, so it's really fun to be on the other side of things now and getting to explore the work.
Well, I think we will explore that work a little later in our discussion, because if we go in order of the concert, we would start with some Johann Strauss and the title of the concert, which is
Evolution of the Dance this time. Yes, exactly. Evolution of the Dance. So, this whole program started by my trying to put together dance-inspired works. And it's a simple enough thing. There's so much to choose from when you can put together a program. But I actually ended up centering on something even more coincidentally unusual. And that was that I found three disparate works, all of which took popular music styles, dance styles, and coincidentally, all music dance styles that are cast in three beats. So these are three-beat dances. And somehow really transformed them, elevated them into something even richer, perhaps, than the original forms. So in the case of Strauss, the distance traveled is not necessarily very far from what the popular dance was to what is in this particular overture. And Strauss, of course, was the famous Waltz King of Vienna. I only recently learned, actually studying this work a little more carefully, that his father, he is of course Johann Strauss II. We're describing here. There was Johann Strauss the Elder, the first, who is probably best remembered now for his Radetzky March, which is the last encore at the New Year's Day concert in Vienna every year. But he was of course a famous composer in his own right, and he so didn't want his sons, even though all of them ended up being musicians, he didn't want any of them to be musicians, that he once supposedly beat Johann II because he caught him practicing the violin. I thought this was an amazing anecdote, but the funny thing was that he ended up running off with a mistress or something like that, and Johann went back to playing the violin, and I'm not really sure if the intention was he was just worried that the younger Johann was going to be competition for him on the music circuit, or whether he feared what a musician's life would be like for young Johann. But in any event, once he ran off with that mistress, he didn't have any say. So Johann kept practicing and eclipsed his father's career by quite a bit, and then became this Waltz King of Vienna. So most of the Blue Danube Waltz, of course, most famously, but also the Kaiserwaltz, the Emperor's Waltz, lots of other wonderful pieces.
Right.
And this operetta, the Fledermaus, is in many ways his magnum opus. And the centerpiece of this overture is, of course, a waltz. And it comes from the end of Act Two, which is just a huge party. The operetta itself is really silly. It's quite a hilarious story. But it basically involves a character named Eisenstein, who is convinced by his who's about to go to jail for a brief period of time and is convinced by his friend Falke to instead attend a ball. And what he doesn't tell him, his friend, is that he's also inviting everybody else, his wife and his servant and his jailer and all these other people, and tells him sort of to sneak off and go to this ball. But of course, it's a masked ball, so lots of people are in costume and he can't really tell who. So it's just one of those, 18th and 19th centuries love mistaken identity comedies. And there's a lot of that. And he does end up finally in jail. And Falke admits that this whole thing was a big ruse that he played on him, that he meant to trick him. And there's near marital infidelity and everything else and all this because years ago, Falke had also gone to a costume ball and had gotten very drunk. And he was dressed as a bat. And then he was left to sober up on the streets of Vienna, which was very embarrassing for him, by his friend Eisenstein. So this was revenge for Eisenstein having left him on the streets of Vienna. And of course, that's where the title Die Fledermaus comes from, which just means the bat. So this is really the bat's revenge. This is him getting back. So the overture is a wonderful compendium of basically a lot of the major themes of the work. It sort of wordlessly and in a somewhat mixed up order retells this story.
The Overture to Die Fledermaus by Johann Strauss Jr., and that was a recording by the Period Ensemble, Orchestra Anima Aeterna, led by Jos van Immerseel. And if you tuned in during the music, my guest is Andrew Kohler, who will be conducting this work on Sunday in the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra concert held in Chenery Auditorium. We were discussing this music as we were listening along, and I had picked out this record because it is a little different from everything else. They're taking some of the Viennese style and rethinking it in their own terms here.
I think so. Yeah. So there is some. I mean, it's very popular right now. Of course, it's sort of a companion to the informed historical performance practice. You know, to sort of get as close back to the original document as possible. And I notice that this is one of those recordings that tries very hard to sort of expunge any of the traditions that are often overlaid on this music in Vienna. But, perhaps I'm just a little biased having spent some time in Vienna, but it seems to me that that robs the music of a lot of its joy. So I always think it's funny when I see people saying, there are sort of or-text, the original editions of these scores with editors making comments like, taking time here is not appropriate, or don't drag this out the way that it is often done. It's just simply not standard. But I think that's what makes this music sing and be joyous. So I'd be very interested if any of your listeners would care to join us this Sunday and compare what we've been working very hard to do, because we've been working precisely on these stylistic quirks of the Viennese, rushing certain figures a little bit and then holding back in other moments and really taking some very liberal rubatos, that is to say, stealing time from one place or another. I think it makes this piece intensely charming in a way that makes this particular recording sound a little pale, if I may be so bold as to say it. But I'm very excited about it. And it's just, I think, an incredibly energetic and wonderful work. I have great love for this music, and this is something also that Johannes Brahms admired a lot. There's a funny story of apparently in the day it was very it was very typical for a composer who was asked for an autograph, who was spotted on the street in the 19th century, to sign an autograph with maybe just a few bars of his most famous tune. And apparently Brahms once rather cheekily signed some woman's handkerchief or something like that with the first bars of the Blue Danube, mm-hmm. and then signed it underneath, unfortunately not by Johannes Brahms. So I think he admired Strauss's achievement in a lot of way. Yes, it is light music, but it is truly joyful to hear. And I hope we do a good job transmitting that joy this Sunday.
Well, there's also such a great sense of accomplishment in pulling off light music. It is not as easy as it sounds.
It's not at all as easy. This is something that's cost us a lot of effort, I think, really trying to get these stylistic conventions to really gel together, because a lot of them are very hard to feel, is indeed a tall order. Right. It's very hard. You have to work very hard to make it sound like it was nothing.
Yeah. Well, last time we talked, I think, last spring, I suppose, around May or June, mm-hmm. you were a little sad because some of your very, very best players were moving on because, as always, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony is perpetually young, and you must introduce new players and watch them grow, and it's often a joy to do that, I'm sure, then you have to say goodbye.
It is. I would say it's one of the greatest joys of working in the orchestra is seeing some young musicians really kind of catch on fire. You know, that's an amazing thing to see. In a lot of ways, although we did lose some very fine seniors last year, I have to say that the transition from last year to this year has been among the smoothest that I've yet had. In other words, at least just in terms of sheer numbers, we've lost one of the smallest senior classes. The end of this year will be a very different story then. But it is, in fact, very nice that there's a core, a more substantial core of the orchestra returning than I've had in many years. And the consequence is that I feel that we're actually able to build on last year's work already in this year's season, which is a rare luxury indeed for a youth orchestra to be able to enjoy. So I'm quite pleased to say that I think that, you know, there's almost sort of a 2-year core orchestra that's going from last season into this season, and I think that's helping us with exactly some of these stylistic niceties that we're trying to achieve here in the Strauss and in other works.
Do you think freshmen and juniors have any, and sophomores have any understanding that they're about to become the next leaders of the orchestra in a short time?
You know, actually, I think they do. You'd be surprised. I mean, there are some even younger players who are particularly extraordinary in the group right now, and who are really gifted and frankly, baldly ambitious. I think students often, I'll put it this way, I think some of the best students actually often have a very good sense of self and a sense of their place in the ensemble, and care very deeply about this and want very much to be leaders in it. And I think they already, when they've been putting in the work and they see what they can offer, have a good sense of what they can do. So, in fact, that process is a rather natural one. There are times, of course, where there's just perhaps not the sort of depth of talent that you would want in a particular section from year to year, and maybe there's not really somebody who is a natural choice to step up as leader. But in most sections, there's someone sort of waiting in the wings, someone, and I consciously try and encourage that kind of development by maybe naming some assistant principals or, you know, through a small nod, I rotate wind seating so I could give that person, a younger person, perhaps a good first part in a wind section on one particular work, but maybe not the major work, you know, to sort of see just how they'll do in those positions and then know that much more securely that they're ready for moving up to the big chair, as it were, in future seasons.
Well, you've become accustomed to having one of the Stolberg medalists join the orchestra for one concert a year for several years now. And do they get to spend any real time with this soloist who's perhaps just a little bit older than they are and have basically is in the same age range?
Well, we've been working on that. It's actually quite a difficult thing, and I'd love to see it develop some more. I say difficult only because, again, the reach of the Stolberg keeps getting bigger and bigger. So really the only time we have is a dress rehearsal with the soloist now and then the concert itself. And of course, I frequently see musicians coming up to the soloist at the break and talking in an informal kind of context. Sometimes that's some of the most meaningful interaction you can have, those sort of informal things. But mostly our interaction is musical right now, just because, you know, Laura this year is coming from Philadelphia, and in recent years we've had soloists come from California and all kinds of other places. So they're traveling quite far. They get into town only right before the dress rehearsal and can only stay for that little period of time. But we do try to make the most of what time we have together. And I think just the musical experience of communication that happens there is inspiration enough, because I think the students really keenly perceive. It's amazing to hear how the level of our playing as in the concerto accompaniment changes from, okay, here we are just doing it by ourselves without the soloist here, to all of a sudden, look who's come and stepped on stage. Everybody automatically sort of wakes up and really brings their playing up a notch. So we are thus very excited to welcome Laura back to town, and really excited to get into this Dvorak concerto. It is a quite tricky concerto. And so I've been talking about this dance theme. And of course, we mentioned the waltz. That's a famous dance in three. And Strauss was already the king of it. And he incorporated it into this operetta that we just heard. In this case, there's a little bit more of a distance traveled, because Dvorak, of course, famously was a nationalistic composer who tried to incorporate some of the sounds of his Czech homeland into his music. And one of the most characteristic of those sounds was a dance called a foriant, which is not as furious as the name seems to imply that it is. It's a lot lighter and more fun than that. But basically what it is again a dance in three, but a very fast three this time, really almost felt in one, but not quite. There's a lot of hemiola, which is a sort of technique by which he'll occasionally group, instead of in groupings of three, he'll group notes in pairs, so in groups of two. And then you feel the two-ness of it against the three-ness of it, if you will. And a great example of a foriant is this last movement of the Dvorak concerto. You'll hear at the beginning something that sounds really just like a straight rhythm, pairs of notes, and then all of a sudden a little period at the end of the first sentence, so to speak, that reveals that it's in fact actually in three. And this is also another great introduction to Dvorak's incredible melodic gift and lyricism, because this is essentially sort of a rondo form, and he just keeps coming. I mean, you know, the man just has themes pouring out of him all the time. So there's all kinds of great tunes. Chief among them is a sudden slower tune that you'll hear in the middle section, and that is briefly reprised near the end, which really captures not a dance, but another aspect perhaps of Slavic culture more widely. And that is a more thoughtful, reflective, slower song in two called a dumka, which is the word from which comes from thought. So it's just someone sort of having a reflection.
Well, I'd like to play this last movement. And just before we do that, I mentioned to you, Andrew, that this is a very young Midori.
Fantastic.
With the New York Philharmonic. And of course, Midori is going to be on the
February concert. That's right.
That's right.
Yes, with the Junior Symphony and with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. One of our big celebrations this year.
Music by Dvorak. That's the finale to the Violin Concerto. And you can hear a full live performance Sunday afternoon at 4 in Chanary Auditorium when the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony takes the stage with Stolberg bronze medalist Laura Park. It should be a wonderful event. And here, if you've just tuned in, I'm still talking to conductor Andrew Kohler about the concert on Sunday. Tickets will be available at the door, Andrew.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
As well, you can look at the website, kjso.org.
You got it.
That's how I get there. So Laura Park and the Dvorak Concerto with a theme of evolution of the dance.
That's right. And we just heard that third movement, which is, you know, taking this Czech folk dance as foreground. And I hope your listeners heard some of those cross rhythms between pairs of two and groupings of three that really give this such vibrancy, this music.
And it sounds more complicated than, no, it talking about it is more complicated than listening to it, I think.
And playing it is also more complicated than listening to it. Yes, exactly. It sounds so natural somehow, but it is very tricky to feel some of these cross rhythms and just there's a furious pace to this last movement, and that was particularly brilliantly played, of course, by Midori. So, and I'm sure Laura will be wonderful this Sunday as well. Which I guess brings us then to the last work and perhaps least known work on the program. And I don't think we'll have a chance to even listen to the real dance in three here, but I'll describe it. So this is a piece by an American composer named Norman Dellogioio, whose last name was originally DiGioio, I think. It was of Italian parentage. And this was actually a orchestration of a piano sonata, interestingly enough. But having heard both now, I can't. One longs for the orchestral version. Maybe that's just me, again, my bias, but there's such color and such immediacy in the sound with the full orchestra there. And it's a really amazing work, and I can't for the life of me imagine why it's not done more often. I think it's a wonderful example of American composition. It's got great weight and profundity, but a lot of the fun. It really brings the even very ancient past into conversation with the 20th century in a way that is sort of seamless, like makes sense, doesn't sound like an awkward juxtaposition, and meaningful all at once. It's really tremendous music. And the name of it is very straightforward. It's Variations Chaconne Finale, and those are the three movements of it, sure enough. And I think we're going to listen to a little bit of the Variations movement, which is, I think, a great place to start here, just because that is perhaps where the present and past are most closely living together. He starts with this wonderful unadorned oboe solo, and what is actually being stated there is a quote from a Gregorian chant. It's from the Kyrie of the Missa di Angelis, the Mass of Angels. So we're talking way back in music history. He's reaching back. And he uses this as a springboard for a series of varied, different variations, each one having its own very distinct character. And even in that first, right after that first statement by the oboe, the strings sort of join and a few other wind instruments join, just a very gentle sort of first statement of the theme. But right near the end, you hear sort of this very lightly jazzy chord. And right there in the span of maybe 20 seconds, we've traveled from, you know, 1100 to mid 20th century New York, which is shortly after World War II, which is when Dellogioio was writing this. And then afterwards, there's a series. The first variation is very gentle. The second one is sort of a exciting scherzo. And then there's this heavy-footed dance. And there's even a funereal variant. So it's all over the map. And in all of it, you hear his capability with rhythmic vitality, a sort of jazzy rhythmic vitality, some jazz harmonies, but also really a real fealty to this variations form and etching this out in a very almost classical way. I think it's a great tribute to the past while still really staying in what was the present then for Dellogioio. It's the second movement, the chaconne. That's a Baroque dance form in three. And that's really where the dance element comes in the evolution of it. Bach famously took this dance and turned it into this great, severe, somber reflection of the human spirit. And it's that inspiration, I think, that Dellogioio is working with in his second movement, Chaconne. It is the darkest part of the work. It's really the sort of heart of it. And it's a really intense and chromatic and sort of searing statement. And I think that's what elevates this work into something really, really quite great. And then the final movement, he blows off some steam, and then he says, okay, so if that was a dance that maybe had evolved so much that it's not even recognizable as a dance anymore, let me give you something that feels a little bit more like a dance. And there's just this great jazz tune, and it starts with this wonderful timpani riff at the beginning, and then some pizzicatos in the strings, and it's just energy all the way through. And then he briefly stops right near the end, and then takes one of the motives that he's been using this last movement and uses an accompaniment to bring back in chorale form the theme from the very beginning that we're about to hear in the oboe now.
I have to ask, is this a special work to you? You've programmed it more than once.
You're right. This is the first time in Kalamazoo that I'm redoing a piece of music, and it is a special work for me because it's a work that I first discovered in the youth orchestra. I think we're going to hear a recording maybe of the Philadelphia Orchestra in Ormandy conducting, and my old youth orchestra conductor, I grew up in the Philadelphia area, was formerly a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and that's where he certainly discovered the work. And it's been a work that stayed with me for a long time. He passed away right about the time that I moved to town, and his memory certainly still lives large in my musical imagination, and I just happen to think it's a great work. It's a great way to remember him as well.
Andrew Kohler, conductor of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, thanks for coming in to WMUK.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Kara.